If you love coffee, then you know that the secret to making the best coffee is no miracle. It's starting with freshly roasted beans. But there's no way to know when the coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe was roasted. It could be sitting on the shelf for months before it gets to you. So thank Brian for Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste. After all, we're all individuals.
I'm not.
Best of all, Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that you know you're getting only the freshest coffee. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for you to start drinking coffee that's good enough for Jehovah. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Good day, movie nerds, and many thanks for popping in your earbuds to hear the next 100 Project, the every Monday podcast that looks back at classic films. And in looking back, we drop lots of spoilers on you. My name is Ryan of Nazareth, and with me as always is the leader of the PFJ, or is it the JPF? My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Of Bolton. Listen to the cheesemakers.
Oh, that's nice. They'd have an hell of a time.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Monty Python's Life of Brian. Brian. Who is my favorite member of Monty Python?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's Eric Idle. And that's because one time, Ryan met him.
That's not the reason, but it doesn't
Well,
hurt.
And he was cool. And he is also definitely in the top three of Monty Python's.
I barely knew who he was when I met him. I knew the name. I'd heard of Monty Python, but I don't know if I'd seen any of the movies. But if I saw him now, I'd say, look, dude, I'm not bullshitting you. You're my man here. However, Michael Palin is the most versatile.
Yeah.
And maybe the best actor of the six of them as well. I should ask you who your favorite Python is.
Oh, God, I don't know if I do have a favorite. I think I like Michael Palin just because I came to Monty Python first via A Fish Called Wanda. I saw that first and kind of loved those two actors and then discovered Monty Python from there.
So John Cleese and Michael Palin.
Yeah, Michael Palin plays a great character with the stammer. But I love them all. I'm a big Monty Python fan.
All right then, the next 100 Project's 58th motion pick. Monty Python's Life of Brian was not American, so it couldn't have been nominated for any AFI Top 100 list. George Harrison's, yes, George Harrison of the Beatles, his production company Handmade Films, put up the bucks and released the picture on August 17, 1979. It cost about $4 million to make, but Harrison's gamble paid off because it made a ton of pounds. Well, Bev, the movie's quite old, but explain it to people with the skinny.
Graham Chapman is Brian.
Brian.
Just a regular young man trying to live his life in Judea during the time of Jesus Christ. A beautiful woman lures him into an underground group of revolutionaries whose acts of resistance get the attention of Roman centurions. On the lam, Brian disguises himself as a street preacher, repeating the words he heard on a certain Sermon on the Mount, and accidentally gaining the unwanted yet very persistent attentions of devoted followers who have now mistaken him for the Messiah.
Or, in a nutshell, Half-Breed is sentenced to death in lieu of his childhood neighbor, his fellow barn baby.
Oh yeah, that's right. The half-breed. First time he's mistaken for the Messiah.
And he's a half-breed because he's Roman and Jewish. Brian Cohen. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 96% of critics like the movie, 55 fresh, only 2 rotten, and 93% of audiences. It's also 181st on the IMDb's 250. Holy Grail's even higher. And the movie was 28th on the British Film Institute's Top 100 British Films list. That's pretty impressive for Brit films. Not a ton of comedies, as I recall, mostly dramas. And apparently the troupe thinks this is their best work. I think they're correct. What does Bev think?
I absolutely agree. It's a gem. Still one of the funniest, smartiest. That's right. The funniest, smartest comedies ever made. I've been watching this movie for almost 30 years, and I still marvel at the brilliance of it.
And coincidentally, we just happened to watch Monty Python and the Holy Grail a few hours ago.
Well, it's not a coincidence. It's because, you know, we watched Life of Brian, and then we were reading all about Monty Python, and then it was like, what are we going to watch this afternoon? Well,
okay, well, coincidence aside,
right there on the shelf.
We did watch it, and I don't think it's nearly as good as Life of Brian.
I mean, it's great. You're comparing two amazing, hilarious movies, but I absolutely prefer Life of Brian.
I think it's flat out funnier. I think it makes more sense as a, well, not really a plot, I guess, but then it is leading to the same place that Jesus led, which is on the cross.
Well, I mean, Holy Grail barely has a plot. It truly just seems like this kind of mishmash collection of skits the way the show was. Whereas Life of Brian, yeah, it's that too. It's very episodic, but it does seem to have a more coherent plot overall.
Because it is driving towards that ending where he's going to be crucified.
That great ending. Most controversial part of the film that was pretty controversial.
Well, the first controversy with this picture, maybe the scriptwriting process was, but that was public, would have been when EMI screwed them right before production was to begin, and that's why George Harrison, who was a huge fan, swept in and Supermaned them and said, well, I want to see more. I can't do an impression of George Harrison, but I want to see more Monty Python movies. So he fronted the money. Apparently, he took mortgages on his house. Seems unusual he wouldn't have more money than just throw it out there. He should have been rich enough. But anyway, the point is that he paid for the movie because he wanted to see them do more of them.
Yeah, Terry Jones later called it the world's most expensive cinema ticket. I think it was Michael Palin in a documentary I watched about the making of the film called him St. George of Harrison. The miracle of St. George the Harrison. That he came in at the last minute. The EMI guy had approved the film, said it was a funny script he ever read, was totally gung-ho. And then days before they were set to go to Tunisia to shoot it, the big boss read the script and was outraged and was like, typical? I'm not taking a risk like this.
Let's read it the last second. Well, their joke title was Jesus Christ's Lust for Glory. Or even would have been Brian of Nazareth, which would have been a good title, too.
Well, the title Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory was the very first thing they wrote about the film. It was a joke that when they were on the press tour for Holy Grail, and everyone kept asking them, what's your next film, what's your next film? And they're like, we don't know. And then I think it was Eric Idle made it up. Oh, it's going to be Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. Because at the time, the UK version of Patton, this title was Patton, Lust for Glory. And so that was a joke, and then they just ran with it. They just thought it was a great idea.
I wonder if Biplanes ever shot at Jesus, and he just said, come on! Deserve some medals there, you sons of bitches! You know why this movie isn't blasphemous, at least to me? I'm not a follower, so I can say this easier than somebody who is a follower. But they make fun of Jesus' neighbor, but not Jesus himself. The one time we even see Jesus, he's giving the Sermon on the Mount. He's not being insulted. They're not even insulting the message. They just don't hear the message, and that's where the cheesemaker's line, blessed are the Greek.
Mm-hmm. They're not making fun of Jesus at all. They're making fun of people misinterpreting or getting crazy devout over weird random things. And they said that they tried to write Jesus into the script initially, but they just simply found that Jesus is impossible to make fun of because they agreed with everything he said. Like, there's nothing really mockable about the figure of Jesus. He truly was a great guy whose teachings were true and palatable. They agreed with, you know, they loved it. So even though they were agnostic, they still have to admit that Jesus is not really a figure that's easy to poke fun at. So instead they poke fun at everybody's blind faith.
I think that makes more sense anyway, because that is the more mockable thing.
No wonder people were outraged, because the people who were most offended by the film were devout Christians who are fussy about all the little details of exactly how you worship rather than the words of Christ.
Well, the actors have since argued about whether the movie's blasphemous or heretical. I think as far as being blasphemous goes, it's actually pretty gentle and good-natured. If you want to call it offensive, I get that. I don't agree with that. But they are not being mean-spirited like a lot of other movies maybe could be. One of the many followers of this style, Monty Python style, would be South Park. And those guys have been funny a lot of the times, but they definitely intend to offend. If they were to say, I'm not trying to offend, Bill Maher's another one, I'm not trying to offend anybody. Yes, you guys are. You're trying to provoke people, I think, whether they want to admit it or not. I don't think the Simpsons people generally are, and I don't know if Python was either. But the Python thing in this movie is to not be mean about the message, even from Brian, who's not even trying to sell a message. He's just trying to live and loses his shoe, and then suddenly that's a sign.
Terry Jones said the film is not blasphemous, but it is heretical. It's not blasphemous because they acknowledge the existence of God and that Jesus is the Messiah, but it's heretical because it casts doubt on dogma.
Jones was the director. He directed their first three films, Holy Grail, with Terry Gilliam. Yeah. They were co-directors. But then I guess there is a bit of a conflict. Gilliam and the actors clashed a lot. Gilliam did cast some of these guys in other movies he did. Not a lot, though, in the movies when he became a director. So I guess there wasn't enough of a clash there. But he kept working with them, so I guess it wasn't that bad. Yeah, but Jones directed this on his own, and he did Meaning of Life. And that's not one of my favorites. I hate the barf scene. I think it's stupid and not funny at all. A lot of people love that scene. But what a great start for any director to have in his canon as a director, Terry Jones.
Terry Jones just wants to kind of shoot straight-ahead comedy, let the writing and the acting carry the movie. Whereas Gilliam, he's truly a production designer. He just loves costumes and set pieces.
And animation.
And stuff. And animation. It's funny because we just watched Holy Grail. You know, there's that great dragon boat at the end. Clearly, Terry Gilliam like just had a blast making that thing. It's needlessly ornate and stylized. And in between Holy Grail and Life of Brian, he had directed Jabberwocky. And he kind of knew that after this, he was going to have his own career where he would get to make his own stuff that doesn't necessarily jive with Monty Python.
Maybe he wanted to be a director and not have to collaborate because you got six guys working on all these movies.
And you know that they all have ideas about how it should look, how it should block, what these characters should wear. There's got to be a lot of collaboration on that set. Although apparently they got along well. Once they were there, the separation of tasks between Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam must have worked. They say this was their peak relationship. This is the best they ever worked together. By all accounts, there was very little friction. Everything went well.
Maybe it's like the Coen brothers. They hashed out in the writing room, and then when you get on set, they're fully in agreement. People have always said that about the Coens, and maybe it was the same with the Pythons, at least in this one case, where they didn't have problems on set because they had all of those fights and all those disagreements months before, as you should. But as far as the acting goes, they played 40 characters between them. I didn't look up how many characters they played in Holy Grail or the other movies they did, but that's a lot of the cast. Mostly it's the six of them. They had some women and they had some other actors. But apart from Sue Jones-Davies, who played Judith, Brian's love interest, who mostly did TV, by the way, not a lot of other big films for her, it's the six of them almost entirely and her.
They just cast themselves in all those little parts rather than letting the part go to someone else.
And they're pretty smart when they have some of the same actors in some of the same scenes and how they make that work.
Mm-hmm.
Just obviously have a double and shoot from behind or whatnot. But they didn't really have a lot of process photography or tricks where they actually had, say, John Cleese acting with John Cleese that I can recall anyway, did they?
No, I don't think so. They just shoot one and then the other. They aren't in the business of trying to dazzle us with effects. They're just trying to be funny.
They're certainly not above lowbrow humor and cheap jokes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have too many of them, I wouldn't say. And generally the jokes are pretty smart and not lowbrow. And this is actually a very smart joke, but it is lowbrow in the way that it's pretty offensive. You were raped? Well, at first, yes. That is a great joke, even though it's pretty terrible, especially in retrospect. What do you think about that joke now?
Oh, God, do you really want to know? I never liked that joke.
Is it easier to deal with when a man is playing the woman delivering the joke? Or is it worse?
I don't think it makes it easier. Okay, so I don't feel this way necessarily about male actors playing women, but there is a blackface aspect to it. It's not the same as blackface. Okay. It's a whole different history to it. There's a lot of different context, but it's blackface adjacent. I think that when men are playing women, they can often be incredibly cruel about women's nature. This is actually probably a great example of it. She's a slut. She's a terrible mother. She's a terrible person. Everything she does is the worst kind of woman.
What about when all the women are acting like men, wearing fake beards and going after the stoning?
Well, they're not acting like men because men apparently don't give a damn about going to stonings. It's only women do. They just have to pretend to be men. And that terrible instinct, actually, that part always made me laugh so hard. Why are women the only ones who are angry enough that they want to murder a man, like throw stones at him until he's dead?
So maybe that's progressive, even though it's actually worse in the sense of trying to hurt somebody.
Yeah, I saw this movie for the first time when I was too young to really sort out how I felt about those kinds of jokes. But I remember seeing those scenes and not really knowing what to make about how I felt about the way gender is treated in this. Compared to, say, something else that I was watching around the same time I discovered Life of Brian, Kids in the Hall, also a comedy troupe, really big in Canada. I honestly don't know what their influence is outside of Canada. And again, five men, they play most of the women's parts. But when they play women's parts, they just keep their voice normal. They're physically act the same way they acted when they were men, really. They just don't seem to put on all that much femininity. They don't perform femininity.
Neither does Terry Jones.
Well, he does a falsetto voice. Although he also has 5 o'clock shadow.
Maybe they feel like they got away with it then, or if they even had done the movie now and still get away with it in their minds because it is so silly and it is so over the top and it is so blatantly obvious that he's not a woman. It's not a matter of saying, wait a second, is that one of the Pythons in that role? Or is that an actual woman? You know, immediately, maybe you don't know it's Terry Jones, because sometimes in these roles, Holy Grail even more so, I found this, wait, is that Palin? Well, that's Palin, right, right. And that's Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And Cleese is always easy to figure out, and Graham Chapman doesn't play that many characters because he's always the straight man lead. But because they're playing such silly non-women, maybe that's why they figure they'd get away with it, because it is just for laughs. It isn't in any way real.
Yeah, and like I said at the beginning, it really doesn't bother me that much. I think it's something worth thinking about when you're watching men play women. They should be careful, the same way that if you're a skinny actor playing an overweight person, like in a fat suit, you should probably be careful about how you portray that. People should know better than to ever portray a different race, although every year somebody...
We've both recently watched Tropic Thunder, and it's still funny.
Okay, but Tropic Thunder is lampooning
That's
it.
That's true. And the one black character in the group is always on top of Robert Downey Jr.'s
yeah, exactly.
Kirk Lazarus for playing the black
He's
man with the movie.
He's the butt of the joke for that. But 3 or 4 years ago, Cloud Atlas came out, and you totally have actors playing different races.
Right.
I think in that case, you have black actors or Asian actors playing white people, too, so...
Well, this is easy for two white people to say, but then you're a woman, so you've got a bit of a minority thing going on there. If you played some other race, or if you played a woman and you're a man, and you're not doing it to be insulting, and you're not doing it for laughs, you're not doing it cheaply, is it still awful? Is it still... a bridge too far.
Well, it's a line. I'm a woman, but I am a white woman, and I know that comes with a lot of short-sightedness on my part, so I'm certainly not going to speak on dressing up as different races, whether it's for comedy, whether it's taken seriously. I think that there's definitely a spectrum of what's offensive and what's not. If I was in the position to create these things, I would just not go there.
This movie is often brought up in the most controversial films of all time, and usually that list includes things like, what's it called, Salo, the one that's all about sadomasochism, and Passion of the Christ, which is about beating Jesus to death, and other sexual movies, I guess Basic Instinct, maybe not so much that, but those kinds of films where there's blatantly offensive things to the general public. I'm not offended by almost any of it, except Salo. That was not a good movie, and I also thought it was offensive in all the shitty ways. But I'm also drawn to perverse things. I've told you this before. I've probably said this in the podcast before. More and more as I get older. I still haven't watched a Serbian film, but I will one day. And I've heard that film is really tough to watch. I finally watched the Centipede films not that long ago. And actually, the first one at least has got some interesting stuff in it. And it's not nearly as disgusting as you think it's going to be. But Life of Brian is offensive, or on the offensive list for a lot of people. The most controversial films of all time list, because of the subject matter only. They swear here and there. I don't think there's, oh, there is nudity. Sorry, because you see Brian's dick. It isn't a sexual film, though. It's entirely about the subject matter. But then again, look at Clerks. It almost got an X rating for the dialogue alone. There's nothing violent. There's no blood. There's no nudity at all. It's entirely the language. And this film is almost like that, too, except you do see the naked man from a distance, though, too. Brian Cohen and his little member.
And I don't want to give anyone the impression that there was any controversy about the gender in this film. You know what's funny is it's kind of progressive in a way. For 1979, it is definitely progressive in the way that they treat Stan / Loretta. Stan wants to be Loretta.
Right, yeah.
And they are actually pretty accepting of it. I mean, he's...
Him or her.
Him or her, yeah. Reg at one point says, well, I think you're divorced from reality. Like, he's kind of dismissive of it. But after that little snippy remark, they totally call him Loretta. They accept all of his language policing. They're totally down with it.
That is unusual for that.
It was good. For 1979, that is pretty progressive.
That's very unusual in 1999.
One of the most controversial parts of the film that we haven't really talked about yet is the ending. And it's not like the ending is...
Always meet on the bright side of life.
People were offended that they would just lightly treat crucifixion, period. Mm-hmm. Their point was, listen, Jesus wasn't the only person that was crucified. That was the main way that they executed people. So we're just like making fun of this thing that happened. It has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. He wasn't there. It's not Good Friday that they're portraying. It's a random group of people in Judea being crucified. They're not even all Jewish. Some of them are Samaritans,
right,
complaining about being crucified in the Jewish
And Jesus
section.
Isn't even one of them. It's not like he's off to the
no,
side.
No,
or
no,
like
exactly.
That. Because Brian has taken his place, essentially, not really. But also you've got the I'm Spartacus homage, which also has crucifixion in it at the end. And there's many, many of them are crucified. If people know Spartacus, and they probably know the scene at least. I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
And so is my wife.
But in that movie that's a complete drama, Spartacus, they're all put up on the cross, including the actual Spartacus, because it's one of those deals where, well, if you want to be guilty, then you're all guilty.
So the guys on set even said when they saw the setup and they saw the silhouette of those crosses up against the sky with the actors up on it, they knew just that image alone, treating that with anything but reverence, was going to get them in trouble. And it did. Although a lot of people who complained about the film never watched it. There were 11 pages of the script that got leaked and sent to a woman named Mary Whitehouse, who was the leader of a group called the Festival of Light. Obviously not still going strong, or they certainly aren't in the media anymore, but they're a religious organization, and they crusaded against the film after receiving these pages, which included the ex-leper. The ex-leper who wasn't grateful for being cured by Jesus.
That do-gooder!
Instead of doing like a full-blast aggressive campaign, their campaign was to pray for the failure of the film, which instead gave the film tons of free publicity.
Of course.
It was a hit in the States. They increased the number of theaters that it was playing in because they were getting so much publicity from her organization and other organizations like it.
The Trump effect.
Yeah.
Bad publicity is great publicity. I'm not offended by this. Like I said, I'm not really offended by anything in this picture because I think it's funny and it's trying to be funny. And that's really what it comes down to because I think it was Chris Rock that said it first, and I've stolen this from him for many years. You can make anything funny, including old man falling down a flight of stairs. Or throwing an old man down a flight of stairs, actually. As long as you make it funny, then it's funny. The one thing, though, the crack suicide squad at the end, when they come to save Brian and they stab themselves, that's a bit of a subplot, actually, that was cut out. Mm-hmm. And they had to leave that in because those characters are on the ground when other people come up to talk to Brian on the cross, so they had to leave them in there. It's still a funny moment, even if you don't know who those people are, and you wouldn't if you didn't know that subplot. The fact that they just come out of nowhere, kill themselves, and that's it, is pretty funny. But what I'm bringing this up for is, I don't think it is, but could it be mocking the immolating monks in Vietnam who were protesting something by committing suicide?
I'm just going to choose to believe that they couldn't have possibly been making fun of those monks. That's just too tragic and too earnest, and even now, decades later, it's just too close to the skin to be something you make fun of. Although it is curious that they are a suicide squad, because I watched the deleted scenes that they were in and their subplot, and they're meant to take after Nazis. They're meant to be Jewish Nazis, right. Which was just, I mean, there's arguments about whether it was cut for controversy or cut because it just wasn't funny enough and it killed the pace. To be honest, it's not funny enough. It's not that great. But they're clearly, they have Hitler mustaches. Their symbol is a very boldly displayed Star of David with lines coming out of each of the points to resemble a swastika. And they argue for the purity of the Jewish race. But Nazis weren't suicidal. So it's like a curious way for them to end. Although in the scene that's cut out, they only pretend to commit suicide. So it might explain why they then are tapping their toes to the song,
during the song.
At the end.
Which is written by my man, Eric Idle. I didn't know that. I had looked it up. I thought they must have got the song from somewhere else. But it says online, and it says in the credits of the movie itself, written by Eric Idle.
Yeah, by the time I saw the movie, the song was so ubiquitous that I assumed it was an old standard. Mm-hmm. And that they maybe changed the lyrics a little bit to make them a little bawdier, right?
That's what I would have thought, too, at the very least, yeah.
No, it was written for the movie. It's just so perfect. And the documentary I watched, John Cleese was praising how that was just a little bit of genius from him. He's like, he wrote that song in no time, and it was
and it's catchy as hell.
We've been singing it all weekend.
And Jack Nicholson did it in As Good As It Gets. I'm sure it's been a lot of movies, but I always think of that one first and foremost.
And it wasn't just influential to movies. Back in 1982, shortly after the movie came out, during the Falklands War, there were sailors that were stuck on the severely damaged destroyer, and they were waiting to be rescued, whether they knew they were going to make it or not, in order to kill time. They were all reportedly singing the song appropriately.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it.
It was a song everybody apparently in Manchester was singing after they lost the bid for the 2000 Olympics to Sydney. I guess it's like a British tradition now when things are at their worst. You sing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
So maybe it was a great way to end the movie, not just a good way to end the movie.
I don't know if when you saw the movie for the first time, if you saw it coming. It blew my mind, my little teenage mind.
Just like Holy Grail ends with the movie not really ending. It's just this modern band of policemen come in and stop them from filming, and they just get in the way. The shot cuts to black, and then they have the end music with no credits. The movie's just over. It's almost like they ran out of money. I think maybe they did run out of money. But they just end the movie abruptly. This one's actually got a more logical ending, because if you're going to have a movie that's even adjacent to Jesus, then you should have a crucifixion. When you look at the wide shot, it looks like even Brian is singing along, or at least moving his feet in some kind of way, because the whole sequence where everyone starts getting into the singing of the song, he's not in any of the close-ups or even medium shots, but the long shot, it looks like he's toe-tapping.
Oh yeah, I agree that he's into it by the end. The first time I saw it, I couldn't even laugh. I was just blown away by the brilliance of all these people about to die and the tragedy of it all, and Eric Idle popping up.
This Cockney accent.
This accent is just this beautiful, enthusiastic tribute to optimism in the worst possible scenario.
And it's not the same character, I don't think. They play so many characters, it's hard to keep them all straight. But Eric Idle, just before they all get sent out to their crosses, crucifixion, no freedom. Freedom for me! I was just pulling your leg, it's crucifixion.
That character is called Mr. Cheeky. His right. name is Mr.
And he gets
Cheeky.
Taken down, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, right. Because he's the first one to say, I'm Brian.
That's right. So then the two versions of Idol in that last sequence are both very upbeat.
Yes.
One who's all cheeky, and then the other one who actually starts the singing, even though they're all about to die. I don't think anybody who watches this movie or anybody who knows anything about crucifixion or anything about, say, waterboarding or terrible punishments, terrible deaths, would ever mock that kind of stuff to mock the person being tortured or punished. They're mocking the people that buy into it. They're mocking the situation. Clearly, they're not mocking it directly.
No, there's a sweetness to it. And I think that they do have a sweetness. You know, they love silliness. but they just love doing the least expected thing possible. Same as the ending for Holy Grail, where, you know, people dress like it's the 70s come out
and stop the movie.
Like, actual modern cops drive up in a car and arrest them because they killed someone, like, back in Act 1.
It's going to be a big battle on them. Yeah,
and then they get arrested. And it's hilarious, and it's just so strange. The influence of Monty Python in general, I think, was to introduce absurdity. Mm-hmm. Their comedy was so surreal. I see that in so many things. Now, we already talked about Trey Parker and Matt Stone. They absolutely have admitted that they are devotees
of... As are the Simpsons.
Monty Python, Matt Groening has said, and I'm sure that plenty of writers on the Simpsons, heavily influenced by Monty Python, SNL, and then even you get to really extreme things like Tim and Eric, a lot of Adult Swim stuff seem to be grown from the seeds that were planted by Monty Python.
Or all their children, yeah. I think.
Trying to describe the influence of Monty Python is like trying to describe the influence of the Beatles. It's so thorough. It was such a touchstone comedy that it's touched everything.
One thing they get right in a very real way, not surreal, is the politics part and the political action groups like the PFJ and the JPF, JFP, whatever the hell it is, that do nothing but bitch. And that very famous scene, it's such a great one, about... What have they done for us lately? Well, the roads, the aqueducts.
The aqueduct.
What have the Romans done for us?
Oh, they kept their streets safe at night. Oh, there's that.
It's like people now that bitch about paying taxes. What has that ever done for anybody? Well, hospitals and schools and roads and stoplights and highways and parks and transit systems, even if they're privately funded also. So many things we all benefit from all the time. Shut up.
But what have you done for me lately? Michael Palin said that they were sending up all the various groups. They were modeled after modern resistance movements. They said they all had these obscure acronyms and they all had these conflicting agendas. They would spend more time fighting with each other over these petty conflicts than they would fighting the real power, which... There's a phenomenon. It's called the narcissism of small differences, and it's based on the notion that when you hate the powers that be, but you truly are powerless against the powers that be, you take all that rage and you kind of direct it at whoever's next to you. Even though you have far more in common with this person you're fighting with, you direct it at them instead of the Romans. And I love how even in their own united group, they spend most of their time debating about what to do. Literally, one of the things they debate is whether or not they should continue to waste so much time debating.
Yeah, and at the end they go to try to help Brian, but they're just debating that too.
Yeah.
He's actually their friend. They know him. The other people that show up aren't really that close to him, but they are more close to him. And they don't do anything for him either.
But they have to stop and read the minutes of the meeting.
Right.
And then vote.
Well, that is one of the great little speeches. And of course, John Cleese is the main guy doing that. His Cleesian pomposity at its best there. He was a great pompous character in some of their films. But my favorite moment, scene, line, whatever you want to call it, I guess it's a series of lines because it isn't just one sentence, but you are all individuals. You're all different. We are all individuals.
Oh, I'm not. Is there a better line written in a film ever? You know what's cool? None of those people spoke English. All those extras were Tunisians and they spoke, I guess, Arabic or French. But none of them spoke English. They were all reciting their lines phonetically. But it's perfect. And they said that they were planning to re-record all the lines in studio back home because they assumed that it would sound so bad. But they just did such a great job of reciting it phonetically, and it actually made the scene exactly how it should sound like. They're just, like, brainlessly repeating.
You just mentioned Tunisia, and that's where Lucas shot the Tatooine scenes in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I guess they used some of the sets from some other TV show or movie or something like that for their biblical Roman era stuff as well. So they were stealing from other things, other ideas, including the whole spaceship aliens thing. They're bilking off Star Wars a little bit. I didn't really get that. I didn't really like it that much.
Yeah, that's actually dumb. Like the biggest failure in the film.
It's a little weird
in my opinion,
place.
Yeah.
Gilliam obviously would have done the animation for that stuff.
And
probably
the design.
Designed the aliens. Yeah. No, I'm not blaming him, but I don't really think that sequence worked out.
It stands out. It's really off tone.
They do save him from dying when he falls off the pulpit or whatever the hell it is he jumps off or gets pushed. I don't remember how it happened.
Staircase, yeah. He just runs without looking.
And somehow he gets sent right back to where he was when they come back from outer space. Right back down to where he was in Judea.
You lucky bastard. Again, another example of two people with more in common than anyone else who turn against each other. Not that guy in particular, but when he gets jailed. And there's the guy hanging up in the shackles. Yeah. You lucky bastard. You guys should be friends.
Favoritism, eh?
Yeah.
How about the biggest, dickest, don't laugh scene? Where I guess the guys playing the extras honestly couldn't keep from smirking and almost laughing when Michael Palin was trying to make them laugh.
I like liked it the first time I saw the movie, but now that I've watched it
thousands of times. Biggest Dickus is a bit of a lame, cheap joke.
Yeah.
But watching those guys not try to laugh is what makes it at least humorous, if not laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, I usually find that's the part of the film now that I get bored with. Mm. All the Pontius Pilate, actually, I'm just like, I get it, he has a speech impediment, and the crowd is making fun of him.
I do like the haggling scene with Chapman and Idol, though. You're supposed to say, that's not worth that much money.
10 for this, you must be mad.
Sometimes their Britishness really comes through despite the fact they're making a movie set in a different part of the world.
Part of what's radical about the movie is they said when they were preparing for it and they were writing the script that they watched all of these biblical epics, of which there's far more than even the ones that we know about. And they all spoke with this gravity. And
look at Spartacus.
Spartacus is a great example. Ben-Hur is another great example. Ten Commandments, great example, where they all speak as if everybody actually knew that they were living in this hugely important part of history. And so they were like, well, we're making a movie about the people that just happened to be there when all this was happening around them. They don't give a damn about what's going on. They certainly don't know what's going on with Pontius Pilate and with the rulers and the Romans. They barely know about Jesus. They're just kind of trying to live their lives. To let them speak not only without that pomposity, but to speak with Cockney working class British accents was radical and hilarious.
I think Idol's the best one at selling that regular guy approach, because Cleese is pompous in the right way. Chapman's the main character, so he's got to be the straight man anyway. Jones and Palin sink into roles better. I always see Idol and Cleese in their roles, and I guess Chapman too, but Idol and Cleese of the other five so easily. Even Gilliam, I think, can blend into the character he's playing a little bit better. And for that matter, Jones and Holy Grail is a few of the characters I didn't realize he was playing until I was looking it up on the IMDb when we were watching the movie. But Idol and Cleese, yeah, they just stand out so much. I think in a good way. I'm not criticizing for the fact that they don't sink into the roles. They're John Wayne-ing the roles more than anything else. You just know it's them. But Idol is so cheerful so much of the time. I think it's one of the reasons I like him so much in this movie.
Yeah, he is really fun to watch. Apparently, Cleese wanted to play the role of Brian. He says now that he's grateful they didn't let him do it, but he just kind of wanted to be the lead. He's like, I never got a chance to play one character through the whole film, and I just wanted to be the main guy. But they said, you know, first of all, Graham Chapman was just straight up more appropriate for the role, which I think anybody would agree. But second of all, they really wanted him, needed him to play the centurion, to play the Jewish elder, these characters that needed to have that arrogance, that pomposity, that he can pull off better than anybody else.
Well, those guys would know better than we would from their show, but also from whatever they did in rehearsal rooms and the writing room. But I'm guessing that Cleese is a better actor than Chapman and can do more things than Chapman. I think Palin, as I said, is the most versatile and probably the best actor out of all of them. I don't know enough about Graham Chapman to say if he could have done the kind of things that Cleese did, but maybe they all realized that and said, it's kind of like a baseball team saying, okay, you're a great pitcher, but you're going to be more valuable to us if you play shortstop today. The other guy is as good. Maybe he's better, maybe he's not better, but we need you to play that other position because you're going to make that one that much better.
Apparently, there was also concerns about Chapman's drinking at the time. Right. It's certainly no secret that he had a really big drinking problem. And when they were just in the writing room every day, or they took a trip to, I think it was Barbados, where they spent a couple of weeks in Barbados to pound out the script, while they were in pre-production, according to them, he was going through 2 full bottles of gin a day. And he toned it down on set. He realized that people were concerned about him being able to do it at all. I don't know how much longer he lived after this.
Not that much longer. Yeah, he wasn't in some of the later things that they didn't do as a group, but they did where they mixed and matched some of the people, and there wasn't an opportunity to get him in there because he died. I think it was in the 80s.
Yeah, and he drank himself to death, right?
I guess so. But I did hear that when they made this film, he was on the straight and narrow, and he was even the on-set doctor. I guess he actually had a doctorate.
Really?
So he was taking care of minor wounds, and I don't know if he was stitching people up. I don't know how often you get wounded and hurt on film sets. Maybe he was prescribing medication to people.
He was a doctor.
That's what I was reading online. Maybe the IMDb's not accurate, but that's what I read. Well, okay, about the main story that Brian is a prophet, and the story is a proliferation of prophets. They find his shoe. Is it really that hard to believe a Messiah could be anointed so easily and for so little? I don't think so.
Well, the movie's not arguing that he is a Messiah. The movie makes it clear that Jesus is a Messiah. We see the halo of the holy light. We know that he is special, and there's nothing like that with Brian. But I assume, actually, probably your question is meant to say, is it that easy for people to believe that anybody is the Messiah and just start following him? They sum it up in the one scene where they're arguing about the shoes and the gourd. 5 minutes to still centuries of infighting religious groups into this one argument that sums up how absurd it is. I don't think the film's arguing against faith. It's arguing against misplaced faith and these irrelevant arbitrary details.
Well, instead of swearing, Jesus Christ, if you're mad, you say, Jesus Christ. Maybe we should be swearing, Brian Cohen!
Brian Cohen!
He died for our sins, and singing on the way.
Only the real Messiah would deny his divinity. All right, I am the Messiah. He said it.
He's so perplexed all the time. I don't think Cleese could have done that. There you go. Maybe we're saying it right there. Cleese is a better actor, but I don't think he would have been able to do the perplexed incredulousness. I think Cleese would have had a harder time being the victim.
He has too much natural dignity to pull the role pomposity. Off. And the pomposity. He has too much natural arrogance. I think he truly is arrogant. When you see him in interviews, when he talks about religion, he is not worried about hurting anybody's feelings.
He's the only person who's ever done the big furry hat sequence with Stephen Colbert on the Late Show.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was appropriate because Colbert plays an arrogant character when he's doing that little bit. I love that bit so much. And then Cleese had a fellow big furry hat. Seemed right in line to do something like that for him, didn't it?
Back on Messiahs. You know, I had a history teacher, I'll always remember, who said that Life of Brian is one of the most historically accurate films ever made, and certainly the most historically accurate film ever made about first century Judea, comparing it to all the biblical epics. Of course, it's not accurate that an alien picked up Brian and then got in a fight.
Yeah. Maybe it is.
But he says it is accurate that there were these warring factions. They were warring with each other rather than the Romans, and that people were as dissatisfied with the Romans, despite the fact that, in a civic way, Romans made their life better. I mean, nobody likes their occupiers, right? And he said that it was true that there were preachers on every street corner. Jesus wasn't the guy. Jesus was one of many. He was just the guy that stood out and that people ended up following and had a powerful enough message to start a whole religion.
And the Sermon on the Mount probably wouldn't have stood out at the time either, because it's one more guy promising all kinds of great things. Well, maybe a lot of them were promising great things. It may have been negative, awful things. But then they do that great thing at the beginning of the film with, what do you say? Listen to the Greek.
Speak up!
No, the cheesemakers. All that stuff. Big nose.
All the people there at the Sermon on the Mount are the same people that are being crucified at the end of the film. Because it's Mr. Cheeky, and it's Big Nose. Is it the Samaritans? No, they're Jewish. I'm Brian, and so is my wife. They're in that group, too. They probably shot them back-to-back or something, like shot them close together.
Well, we said that George Harrison's company made this film, and bravo to them for doing that. John Goldstone was a producer. He was a Python guy. He did do Holy Grail before this. And the whole troupe wrote the movie because they wrote their own material back then. The movie was 185:1. We watched the DVD, and both it and Holy Grail looked fine. Maybe I should get the Blu-rays one day for us, but that's okay to me. Cinematographer Peter Bijou, I guess is how you say it, Bijou. He shot one of my favorites. We'll probably cover it next year when it'll be the 20-year anniversary, The Truman Show. And he won an Oscar for Mississippi Burning. The editor was Julian Doyle, who did cut Time Bandits for Terry Gilliam, also Meaning of Life, and Brazil for Terry Gilliam, and then he became a director himself. And one thing about Gilliam is that he did, of course, the Bond-esque opening credits with that grand musical theme and the surreal animation.
Man Called Brian.
Does sound so much like a Bond film, doesn't it? The music composer was Jeffrey Burgon, I guess. He only did music for 4 movies. Most of his work has been on TV. And this was big dramatic music, just like in most historical or biblical epics. Next, we've covered most of the influence, including the I Am Spartacus takeoff from Spartacus. This movie redefined satire, even comedy in general, as did Holy Grail and their TV show, for that matter. I think it also is important to say that they show that nothing is sacred, or should be sacred. To steal that theme from Chris Rock, if it's funny, then it's funny, no matter what it is, no matter how controversial it is.
I'll add this, though. If it's going to be controversial, it better be funny.
Yeah.
Because I think people get in the most trouble when they say something controversial, and it doesn't make people laugh.
The awards and list section? Nothing. This is the rare movie when you look it up on IMDb, where the awards section they have there, there's nothing at all.
Yeah, but retrospectively, a lot of people put it on their lists of greatest comedies ever made, greatest British films ever made.
The IMDb never references those in that list, though. That's about things like the Oscars, the Golden Globes, the National Film Registry, which they're not going to put this movie in there because it's not American.
I mean, comedies so rarely win awards. They're just not awarded in this way other kinds of movies.
So it's not an AFI movie. It couldn't be, and it couldn't have made the AFI Top 100 Laughs. But if you could put it on that Laughs list, where would you rank it? Would it make your top 10?
It would make my top 10 comedies. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it introduced me to Monty Python. I know it's a roundabout way to get there. And it's still hilarious.
And having seen Holy Grail even sooner than we've seen Life of Brian as we sit down to record this, if I had to choose between the two of them, there's no contest. I think this one's way better and way funnier and a way better story, way more pace, even though they're about the same length. I don't think there's much of a contest. Even the thing that people love so much, all the nerds seem to love the knee scene. I used to say, knee. It's cute, but I don't think it's all that funny.
What is the deal with the Knights of the Saint Knee, guys? Break it down for me. I love that movie, and there's lots of stuff that I think is totally hilarious. I'm crying, laughing, cracking up. Oh my god, cracking up as we're watching it. I think it's brilliant, but the Knights of Saint Knee, I just don't get it. There's a few movies in my life that have been kind of ruined by fans, and the Holy Grail a little bit because it's like Borat or Austin Powers. I just heard it before I ever saw it a million times. And Knights of Saint Knee is the worst one.
I think my favorite moment in Holy Grail is at the bridge towards the end. And it's Palin. Here he is again. What's your favorite color? Blue. No, wait. Yeah. He's blasted off.
It's so fast. It's so good. Or I love when he's like, what do you mean? European or African swallow? I don't know. This means nothing to anybody who hasn't seen the movie. Were those annoying people quoting the film?
People have seen these movies.
Oh, right. Everyone's seen the movie. Can't be ruined by fans, but when I found Life of Brian, it was totally brand new to me, so that makes it a little more special.
I feel like it's gotten better as I've seen it more often.
Yeah, it's so
I don't know if I really enjoyed it as much as I do now when I first saw it. First time I saw it, I don't think I got it that much.
I can't believe my parents let me watch it when I think about it, because I was maybe 15. Maybe even younger. This is what happens when you're the baby of the family, is your parents are just like, I don't care. What, there's full frontal male nudity? Whatever.
So, well, very briefly. It's not like
a... I know, and it's not really that sexual.
Not giant hard on. Exactly, not sexual. Even though he's just had a night of fucking with his lovely Judith. And you know what? We've talked about how we've covered a few foreign films so far this year. This may not be a foreign language film, but it's not American made.
Okay.
We didn't intend for this to be a foreign film year, but here we are about the middle of April. We've covered, I guess, four movies now that were not made in America.
Well, part of that is because we covered all the AFI films, so we omitted all these amazing films that were made elsewhere other than Hollywood. An embarrassment of riches outside of America.
Well, I like doing this one for Easter because the original thought was to do Last Temptation of Christ, which we could do next year when it'll be the 30-year anniversary. And I love that movie. It's a great film, and it says so much. It taught me so much. It gave me all kinds of feelings and thoughts I never had about the Jesus story. Even though it's not supposed to be real, it is a fantasy, especially that sequence at the end that pisses people off so much. Jesus is a real guy who wants to fuck women? That can't be! Nothing wrong with speculating that maybe he could be, or in their story he is. But this is a 180, and it's more fun.
It's so irreverent. The complete opposite of every other movie that has Jesus as a character.
Okay, Bev, bring us home. Last thoughts?
I would never call myself a Python super fan because that's a really high bar, but I really love them. They're pretty important to me, and this is far and away my favorite Monty Python work. Still totally essential and hilarious 40 years later.
If you're listening to us after all this time and haven't watched the movie, you should have watched the movie because we've done no justice to how funny it really is. Because we're not as good as Chapman, Idle, Jones, Palin, Cleese, and Gilliam. We're off next week to apply paint to eggs as we celebrate Brian Cohen's brutal death. You know how I feel about paint if you heard our Saturday Night Fever podcast, by the way. So when we talk to you again on April 24th, we'll only be a few days away from the beginning of Toronto's annual Hot Docs Film Festival. In line with that, we'll review not one, not two, not three. No, wait, three documentaries. And there will be a theme, movies about movies, and movie making especially. We'll primarily talk about the making of Apocalypse Now, Hearts of Darkness. But we'll also spend some time on Lost Soul. That's the one about the very troubled making of The Island of Dr. Moreau. And thirdly, Vivian Kubrick's Making the Shining, which is a supplement on the Blu-ray and DVD that got released way back in 1980, actually, when they wanted to promote the movie. So the coming attractions trivia that does kind of encompass all three movies. If Marlon Brando and Stanley Kubrick had ever made a movie together at the height of their dithering powers, how long would the shoot take? 6 months? 2 years, or 9.5 years?
All right, so...
What is the correct answer?
For the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, please check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 films that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Well, I guess we would know by now if they were going to do a new list in 2017. Doesn't look like it's going to happen, does it?
I told you they weren't going to do
it. Yeah, I know. You said it, and I was like, they're going to come through.
Their logic is every 10 years means it would have been 2016 because it was 2007 after 1998. Knock a year off each time.
So we did all those films, and every episode is available for free. That is on iTunes. Rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Now fuck off! How shall we fuck off?
And cut.